The following podcast is a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast by Fresh FM, with assistance from New Zealand On Air.
Welcome, listeners. Welcome to Hearth Tales on Fresh FM. Join me, Rich McCoy, as we gather closer to hear the tales of seasoned artists, makers, creative souls, and those who love to support them. Listen to stories of their journeys, how they wrestle with their demons, and how they balance their calling with the scaffolding of admin, life, and self-promotion.
Kia ora, listeners. In the studio with us, we have Shay Vincent. Thank you very much for joining us. Would you be able to introduce yourself and give the listeners a sort of snapshot of who you are and what you do?
Sure. Kia ora. Hi, I'm Shay. I'm from Riverside Community, which for me is really being of place. I'm actually third generation from Riverside, so that's kind of my home, my culture, my where I'm from. And it's quite interesting. As I get older, I understand how different that is to most people's experience. I think coming from Riverside affords me a certain view of the world, or a less leveraged space to be expressing myself from. I'm 55 years old. I have three grown boys and a stepdaughter and a grandson now. I've always worked with plants, and I've always been drawing and creating something as long as I can remember, right back to when I'm like 2 or 3 years old.
And you've been sort of quite deeply involved in how Riverside is put together and stuff. You go into the cafe, and there's a lot of your quite organic looking pieces that are made out of iron and copper is, or whatever what material it is. How do you think that being at Riverside has shaped your creative practice?
I think just having the freedom to be me, and not to have to be so engaged with in the competitive world, I guess, has allowed me a bit more freedom to express my own way of being. Totally informed by the culture of Riverside, of course, which is about sharing and helping each other out and trying to avoid being in competition, I guess.
Really. Because you've got the pieces like the fantails and the tunny fuzz and the all the copper chandeliers and stuff, and they feel really alive. How does working with metal and the space inform the way you think about like living art as well? Like you mentioned, you've always been involved with plants, and I'm kind of interested in how those two inform each other.
The steel art is my sort of Pacifica kind of New Zealand iconic pieces, which are more informed by the icons of our culture and our natural world, but they are my own take on them. There's also a series of earrings with birds as well, which are also in that sort of vein.
They're yours, the ones by the counter.
But the copper pieces are actually much more about growth and decay and the actual fractal sort of patterns of life itself and growth itself. And that's very much about just who I am in the world and what I like to explore and see. And I try to embody that. Often when I'm working, it's really just embodying those movements and repeating those patterns and on a sort of smaller or larger scale as I go work through the piece. So I might be drawing it onto copper, but I actually might just be literally cutting into the copper or other metal with my gas torch and really just feeling it rather than trying to prescribe it, I guess.
Is there anything that you've done that has been like really pivotal in your practice?
When we opened the cafe 2000, and the cafe is now Committee Mitty, which is another whole story, but the cafe was the Riverside Cafe back then, and we rebuilt this old house, which is probably 30-40 years old or something ridiculous, and it was pretty much falling down, but we rebuilt that. And in the process of doing that, we pulled out this scrapbook old hot water cylinder. It was a large cylinder because it had been used as a seasonal workers accommodation for some point. And I just went, oh, that's interesting, and put it aside. And toward the end of the whole project, I went over and just started chopping it up with a gas axe. And it just really worked, what I made. I put up on the wall, everyone was like, wow, it's incredible. And it sold within a few weeks. And I was like, oh, okay. I guess I'm a selling artist now. And started making more from that point, yeah.
So, Aaron, yeah. Nice. Because so, the yeah. chandelier you've got there is really quite breathtaking.
So the chandelier is more recent. That's probably 12, 15 years ago now when I came back to the Riverside. And that was, yeah, so that shows an evolution of my art from some of the original pieces which are in the cafe to the chandelier, which is much more complex, yeah.
And sort of changing things slightly, the bonsai passion that you have, I believe that started quite early in your teens when you were doing, was it biology studies?
So bonsai, so plants in general, I've always worked right. with plants. I've always grown plants of some various different forms. And when I was probably 13, 14, I pulled out some little birch trees and started playing with them as bonsai. I mean, I knew what bonsai was, but I didn't know anything about it. I just sort of started playing with it and added more. And by the time I was 20, I probably had 20 odd bonsais. And then when I came back to Riverside, I had the idea of putting down a nursery, so I put down a whole lot of different cuttings and seeds and things, and a lot of those turned into bonsai in time. So now I have two nurseries full of bonsai of, I don't know how many plants there are, probably 1,000 plants or something, in various stages of development. And yeah, but bonsai is it's where my art and design and my passion for fractal sort of patterns and that sort of thing comes joins up with my horticultural love of trees and plants and flowers. And yeah, so it's an interesting combination, and it doesn't stop. It's a cost sculpture that you recreate every year or every 6 months or three times a year in some cases. it's also a total constant challenge of learning and understanding the plant and how it responds. And it's a very much a relationship with the plant, and that it is growing and you're going, okay, I want these bits to grow forward, and you chop it right back, and then the plant goes, I want to grow there. Bit of a push and pull. Yeah, I went to Japan and spent a brief time in a nursery there, what we have in this country is just, it's nothing compared to any given nursery in Japan. It's just full of stuff, full of incredible plants. And I expected to feel totally overwhelmed by that, but actually I came back going, that's what you can do in time. And I started looking at native plants as well, a lot of which are not very good for bonsai because they have a divariating juvenile stage, which is because they've evolved with moa, which is our giant birds, which was grazing through the forests. So all these plants have these interesting structures to ward off being eaten, basically. And so a lot of our big forest trees have a juvenile stage, which is completely different. But I'm looking at some of these divaricating species, the ones that remain divaricating, so not the big rimus and metis and things, but the smaller trees, and wondering whether we can start developing those as unique New Zealand. I mean, you can call them bonsai or not, but a bonsai literally means a potted tree, so our own style of using those forms and shapes, some of them are quite incredible. Some of them look like chicken wire, or they're very cruciform, or they all hang down, or there's some amazing forms and colours, and the patterns of the little shoots are just brilliant and coloured, and little berries and tiny flowers, and so I'm looking at those and starting to wonder how I can use those to make really interesting
That's fascinating. So the trees in New Zealand have grown differently because of being grazed by things like moa.
Yeah.
Does that happen anywhere else, do you know?
It probably does, but our plants are really well known for it.
I had no idea.
Yeah.
That's really fascinating.
Yeah. So I'm actually going to go up to Canaan sometime soon and do a video on the wide selection that's up there. Some of those forests you walk through and you can just go, wow, I can totally see a moa walking through this forest and how it's nibbling and grazing on these trees. And yeah, so it'd be quite fun. Yeah.
And how does that make a challenge with you using them as bonsai?
Because they don't respond as a lot of bonsai would to right. being shaped and pruned. So they don't like that. So often you'll chop them back and they just go, never mind, and they grow a whole new shoot somewhere. They're really more almost a bush form rather than a tree form. Whereas a tree's trying to extend to the top, to the light, a bush is always producing new shoots low down in the tree, so you're having to constantly battle against these sort of epicormic shoots and things.
Yeah. Crikey. You had beautifully described bonsai as a relationship where missteps become character and wisdom. Do you think the bonsai teaches something about patience and surrender and humility that other art forms don't necessarily do so?
Yeah, I mean, other forms, you make it, it's done, it goes on the wall, or you sell it, whereas a bonsai, it's ongoing, and it just gets better and better, and even a terrible bonsai in time will just get better and better. It's just the nature of the age, which is really telling a story about the plant itself. I mean, a good bonsai should really be telling a story of its history. And I mean, if you look at any tree in the bush, you can look at it and go, oh, it's grown that way, and it's obviously been broken off when the trees overshadowed it there, and it's went that way, and something happened here, and a limb broke out, and you can see the scarring on it. And so you can tell a story of a tree. So a bonsai should be the same, really. You should be able to look at the bonsai, and you can see the story of how it grew and its relationship with its owner. When I was in Japan, I visited a number of nurseries, and each one had a really distinct flavour of their tree. So if I looked at, say, the white pines, and they'd all have a particular character, and you go to another nursery and you can see, oh, these guys did something quite different in the way they approached their tree and the way they trained it. So that's and I think if you were a connoisseur of Japanese bonsai, you could probably look at a tree and pretty much name the nursery it came from.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's fascinating as well. And so your work with native species, and do you see it as a way of sort of reconnecting people with our land here, or do you think there's a story there?
I think there is, and people are really wanting to grow our natives. That's a big one. It's like probably half of the people who are inquiring about bonsai are asking about native trees, and I think that's pretty cool. I mean, it's really people saying, yeah, we want to be of this place and be related to this place. And there are some species which are working. There's a really lovely blue-leafed, I think it's called Metapori blue totara, which has got a lovely little lobed blue leaf, and it's quite dense, and yeah, I think it's going to be a good one for bonsai, so I'm growing quite a few of those.
Is there anybody else that's doing this in the country, or are you the only person?
There are three or four other bonsai nurseries, I guess. I don't think anyone's got as large a sort of collection of particularly Japanese maples available, or consistently good trees. There's a lot of people selling junipers, which they're basically bought out of a nursery, chucked in a bonsai pot, and put $50 on top, kind of thing.
Yeah, right.
Which is, I mean, yeah, in time, if you know what you're doing, they might become interesting bonsai, but there's not really anyone who's got a consistent body of trees available. There are collectors with some pretty nice trees out there. Mostly they are not, they are private collections and you won't see them, but there's some older collections around. And people are trading trees here and there, and it's definitely a growing thing in New Zealand. Bonsai is definitely really is quite trending. There's a growing movement of people. I think what it really teaches people is care, just to be caring for something and to be, so they're a lot more aware of their place in the world and their connection to it, I think, which I think is really good. It's a real antidote to the sort of hyper-personalization and disconnection that I'm seeing anyway, that even I'm feeling it.
Definitely. And would a bonsai last as long as a full-size tree, do they?
Yeah, potentially it will last as long as a full-time tree, yeah. If you maintain it and grow it and know what you're doing and just keep doing it. There's trees that are hundreds and hundreds of years old in Japan, even 1,000-year-old trees. It's crazy.
Wow.
And they slowly get bigger. I mean, the old ones are probably a couple of metres high, and trunks are 30, 40, 50 centimetres thick. And
And there are art forms like bonsai that they can be seen as a bit of a sort of a quiet protest against the hyper-personalisation and the craziness of the world. Do you have any kind of thoughts on that, or...?
It's a very quiet protest. Yeah. It's a very quiet protest, but it is certainly something which, it's a calming it's a calming thing to do. It really puts you in the moment. You're there with your tree. You're not. It takes away a lot of the other stuff that's going on. It's yeah, you because you're there. You're assessing and looking at what's grown, and you're finding that pattern of the tree and working out how to maintain and shape it to make it look and also to thrive, because it's not just about shaping the tree, it's actually setting the tree up so that it's got a maximum amount of light on all its leaves, that it's so that the tree itself is receiving what it needs from the sun and from you as you're feeding it to maintain its growth, because you really want it to be growing quite vigorously. There's a misconception that bonsais stay the same but really you're not, you're growing them as vigorously as you can, because if you don't grow them vigorously, then they're going to look the same in 50 years as they do right now, and you don't want that. You want a 50-year-old tree to look like a 50-year or 100-year-old tree, and that's the thing. So it's a whole lot of techniques to make this tree that's may only be 20 years old look like it's 100 years old. That's all about bringing, you know, shaping the branches. So a young tree, the branches are all straight up, like they're growing hard out. And a few, and then they're all straight. But an old tree, it's all sort of bent and gnarled, and the branches have come down, and the angles are all chopped up all over the place. So that's the art. That's why you put wire on a tree, to shape, to pull the branches down and to form the angles and things on them to make it look like that 1-year-old piece of growth is actually 10 years old.
And what sort of demographic come in and buy trees from you? Is there a pattern, or...?
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, there's a lot of people in their 20s or 30s who often don't have much money, so they're not buying much.
Mm-hmm.
But they'll buy smaller starter trees, or they appreciate the fact that they can buy a tree that's relatively cheap and it's already well set up to become a nice bonsai. And then there's older guys who, a lot of them are immigrants from often England or Germany, and they have had to leave a collection behind.
Oh, yeah.
And they just like, oh, I'm too old to make my own collection up from scratch again. So they go about spending, you know, quite a few $1,000s on a range of trees that they can carry on growing. And then there's usually women who approach me and they say, my dad has always wanted to do bonsai. And so they buy him a bonsai, and it's usually like, he's usually in his 60s, 70s or something, 80s, and he usually rings me up and goes, so they bought me a bonsai, now what do I do?
Which leads me on, I understand you do courses quite a lot as well. You've got one coming up with the winter workshops.
Yeah, I run one once a year with the winter workshops, and I do ones, sometimes do one through the Riverside Community Education Program as well, which I will probably do one this year as well. So.
Right, and how...
So people come along and they learn how to, basically I've got a range of seedlings, and we just, I basically teach people how to put them on rocks, because that's kind of my specialty, is root over rocks. We have a lot of amazing rocks around here, so I'll collect rocks from kilometres away, which I'll have to pack out, or I sneak into my son's packs and retrieve them when they get home.
So you'll be walking along just dropping rocks in your kids' backpacks?
Yeah, when they stop for lunch, I'll just flick one in without them noticing. It's only, yeah, 4 or 5 kilos or something, but they're big strong leads, they don't even notice. I'll teach people how to put a tree onto a rock, and how to set it up so that it will sit really nicely on the tree and on the rock, and yeah, and then a bit of ongoing care and how to do that.
And what do you look like? What do you look for when you're looking at a rock?
So for the tree, with the bonsai, you're miniaturizing your tree. So you're bringing it right down to, like, I don't know, 2% of the original tree or something. So you have to bring, the rock is basically the landscape that you're putting your tree on. So you have to basically miniaturize your landscape as well. So you're imagining a cliff with lots of cracks and holes and fractures and things in it. So you're looking for a rock which has the attributes of an outcrop or a cliff that has all those little structures and cracks and fractures in it. Give it the maximum amount of sort of, yeah, textures and things. Sometimes I just look for fantastical rocks that are just very cool, interesting shapes, or like have holes through them or something like that, which, yeah. Because you can do, I mean, you're not, you know, I mean, if you went to Japan, there's a way that you do things.
Right.
And that makes sense, because if you are creating a tree that's only so big, then there is only room for like 7 branches or 9 branches on the tree, so they have to be in the right place, otherwise it doesn't work. But then you can also be more fantastical or fanciful, or, you know, there's a movement in Europe of fairy tale bonsai, which are basically these gnarly old stumps with big holes, which, and they go off. If there's a fault in the tree, like a big hole or something, these make it bigger. So it's like imagining a tree that some fairy tale person would be crawling up and sleeping in the forest, you know, when the witch is chasing them or something like that. So it's making these really ent-like kind of witchy trees, which is pretty cool.
And you've mentioned people collecting bonsai. Do people tend to go get one and then go, oh, I love this, and get loads? Or
Definitely, it's quite addictive. Yeah, once you get into bonsai, people get quite obsessed by it, especially younger people. I think older people, yeah, they'll be looking around, they'll be scanning the trade before different trees and things like that. But younger people, they'll be like driving around going, oh my god, look at that on the side of the road, and digging trees up even left, right and centre and things like that. It's just you start seeing bonsai everywhere. Where you start sitting down and people are talking away and you're just scanning the trees and looking at the branches and imagining how you'd prune them and correct them to make a more interesting branch out of that tree, and like just full size trees. I mean, this gets into your brain.
And is there a sort of a meditative quality to working with bonsai? I can imagine it being incredibly calming.
Yeah, I find it that way, but I think some people might. Yeah, no, I think generally there is, but I know that some people would be, especially people who are new to it, kind of freak out about it, like, oh my god, what do I do next? How do I do that? And they, yeah. So I've actually been making a whole series of bonsai content on YouTube, excuse me, under the name Hardwired Bonsai, which is really just me working on bonsai. So it's like, it's first person view. So I've basically got a camera sitting in front of me, a tree on a turntable, and I'm spinning it around and critiquing it and doing things to it and wiring it or pulling branches down or cutting it back. And people have new people to bonsai have said that's brilliant, because that's what they need to be seeing, because they need to understand why I'm doing what I'm doing. And yeah, that's been quite popular. It's probably, I don't know, 60-80 little videos up on YouTube which people can check out.
And so you've built quite a body of work with the work at Riverside and the bonsai nursery and stuff. What are you excited about next? What are you working?
Current project is planting forests. So Riverside's a couple of hundred hectares, and I've been taking out all our marginal spaces, so all our swamps and steep spaces, and basically just one of the paddocks was just too far away and it had a swamp between it and the main farm to be workable most of the year, and planting them up into forests that I hope will be permanent, and they are really aimed at our bird life, really. So a lot of natives, but then there's one forest I planted which is trees from all over the world, so it's a bit more of an arboretum. It's really trees that are all either things which will have interesting berries and things for birds, or they're actually just trees that I really like and I want to walk through when I'm an old man. And within that, and within those trees, and I planted it in sort of as natural a sort of style as possible, so sort of drifts of trees, different species mingling through each other. But I've also dropped in some tree cathedrals and some cultural spaces. So a tree cathedral is a deliberately planted form of trees. It might be a circle or a square or whatever. It could even be just a grid that you stand in the middle of, and you've got this incredible line of views out through all the different grid patterns or something like that. So I've done put a few of those in on different places as well within the forests. And I've created a cultural space, which I put, including a planted a stage. So it's they're using columnar cypresses which form a dense sort of hedge. I've created a back and then four wings on each side, two wings on each side, so you've got like basically spaces you can disappear into. And a big round circle of magnolia trees, so it's basically going to be a site for, say, Shakespeare in the Forest, or a rave or a wedding or whatever you want to do with it, really, within a sort of a magnolia and maple forest. And then from there it stretches into a mixed forest and lots of natives, and down to a big swamp with flax and raupo and lots of little ponds and things, which is an interesting quandary, because I planted it for the animals, and I know people are going to want to walk through it. So I'm kind of going, how do I maintain the space for the animals? Because we really need to maintain space for our animals. I travelled through the North Island a couple of years ago, and I was actually quite horrified how few birds there were present in the environment and how developed the landscape was. And I'm looking around going, there's no pikikos even, or not even any hawks. And I'm looking around going, well, where would they even nest? It's all white picket fences and polished paddocks. And it's like, no. And I arrived back in the South Island, I was like, oh my God, thank God for that.
Yeah.
Some wild, some, you know, and lots of birds, and it was just beautiful. Yeah.
And for young people wanting to sort of like combine creativity and the natural world in the way that you have, what sort of advice would you give them quickly?
Just get out into it and really observe that's the patterns and the structures and the fractal nature of growth itself and erosion, for that matter. There's amazing patterns in erosion if you get onto the coasts.
Mm-hmm.
And just understand evolution. Really understand, drop into what evolution is and really understand what evolution is, and that'll actually allow you to understand the world and even understand people, which is a hard thing to do.
Certainly is. And where do people find your work?
I have a website for Bonsai. It's just Jay Vincent Bonsai, which is online. It'd be much appreciated if you go and check that out, even if you don't want to buy something, because I need to get my SEOs up. I'm at Riverside. If you wanted to come and check out my nursery, give me a yell. Then there's contacts on my website. There's Hardwired Bonsai on YouTube, which is, as I've said. And I've done a series of videos on Riverside itself, which is under Living In Community. It's just somehow really not very easy to find, but it's on YouTube as well. I'm around.
Good. And of course, come along to the workshop.
Yeah.
Which is when?
Workshop. I don't know.
I should know. I did the posters for it, but I can't. But yeah, anyway, check out the Motueka Arts Council website, because there'll be tickets available on there. Thank you. That's a really unique practice you have. It's been really fascinating listening to you talk about it.
Thank you.
Wonderful. Thank you very much.
Cheers, Jay.
Jay's workshop is on Saturday, the 23rd of August at 12:30 p.m, which is at Riverside Community off the Mutiary Highway. Definitely drop in. It's quite an experience. Also, while you're there, perhaps bring some milk bottles along. You can get some fresh milk there, and grab a coffee from the committee meeting. Great place. Wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you for lending us your ears. You can find more interviews and how to request a Hearth Tale featuring your favourite New Zealand artist, maker or creative soul on our website, hearthtales.com. And you can listen to this episode of Hearth Tales on freshfm.co.nz with a new show every fortnight. Until next time, fare thee well, friends. Fare thee well.
The podcast you just listened to was a live recording of a radio show, first broadcast on Fresh FM with support from New Zealand On Air. Fresh FM is a community access media station based in Te Tauihu, the top of the South Island, New Zealand. The funding of Access Media makes these podcasts possible. To find similar programs by other community access media stations, go online to accessmedia.nz. If you or your group would like to know more about how you can have a program on our station, please contact us. Visit our website, freshfm.net, for our contact details.